the Epistle to the Romans, chapter 12, with the Lord's help, we will speak from the first two verses. Paul's Epistle to the Romans, chapter 12, the first two verses. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, and be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. We read the 11th chapter in order that we might see the ground upon which the apostle makes this appeal and beseeches the brethren by the mercies of God to present their bodies a living sacrifice. And you would have noticed in reading that chapter that the apostle comes to this place where words fail him to express the majesty and unfolding of God's purposes to his people Israel. For he says, oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways, past finding out. And this is where he had to come, as he was brought in this particular instance, and there's no instance comparable with it, to bring together the purposes of God in the Jew and Gentile, where both are made one in Christ, and where they are classed in the early verses of the 11th chapter as the remnant according to the election of grace. And as he sees this unfolding purpose, which we must remember was practically new to him, for he was not brought up in this truth, we cannot but marvel at the way he is given such a clear view of the amalgamation through grace of the Jew and the Gentile in the person and the work of Christ. And how he speaks of the unbelief of both. How God has determined that in both cases his goodness shall overflow the unbelief of the remnant. It is the remnant that he has in mind, and both of them are, or both parts of the remnant are shown to be brought together by divine grace in this most remarkable way. And he himself is like Moses very much. He stood in the breach. He was a Jew, and he boasted of it. And yet God called him to be the minister to the Gentiles. Had to go against his own people. And this remarkable fact must never be overlooked by us, that God did not send a Gentile to the Gentiles, but he sent a Jew to the Gentiles, even as he sent a Jew to redeem the Church of God, Jesus Christ. That these remarkable people, the Jews, revealed in their purpose through the history which most of the Bible contains, and yet issues in such a remarkable way and an unheard of way. And this is all, as he tells them, grace. The table of David became a snare and a trap and a stumbling block, and so it did. All the beauties of the ancient temple and the ancient worship were passed away. They're all fulfilled in the person of Christ. And there arose out of this a glorious new covenant, which was ordered in all things and sure, and the covenant that David himself speaks of. O my house be not so with God, yet hath he made with me an everlasting covenant ordered in all things and sure, though he make it not to grow. And this is where poor David had to stop, though he make it not to grow. Because in his day, the poacher of Israel, after death of Solomon, was very dark. But that covenant did grow in later years, and now we see it in its fullness, so that the word of Jacob and Israel are words that apply to the true church of God. And thus Paul marvels at God's great wisdom, the depth of this remarkable work whereby they are called to work together, and where the old feelings of animosity, prejudice, or the Jews even had no dealings with the Samaritans, who were of the ten tribes, let alone the Gentiles. And Peter, full of prejudice, said that he never touched anything that was common or unclean. Oh, when God breaks down prejudice, you know, it's a wonderful thing. One of those terrors left behind in the fall, prejudice. And you can't get rid of it. We have it in a natural streak, in our natural makeup. A prejudice against particular things. Nothing to do with religion. Particular people. But when it comes into the things of God, which it does, prejudice is a very deadly thing. So that the reason Paul beseeches the brethren is somewhat apparent to us when we realize just what he is beseeching them to do, and how this method of approach is so applicable. It's not a command in the sense that you've got to do it, but I beseech. He is fond of this word, and it is indeed a gospel word. It breathes the spirit of the gospel. It is beseeching. It is no lowering of God's power, but rather an evidence of his tenderness. I beseech you, therefore, on this ground, brethren, by the mercies of God, I do not beseech you in my name or for my sake, but I beseech you for the mercies and by the mercies of God that I've just been speaking about, writing about, of this remarkable work where Jew and Gentile flow into one stream. The purposes of God according to election shall stand. and where there shall be no distinction whatever, and where the wolf shall lie down with the lamb. This gospel, this experience. I beseech you, therefore, on these grounds, the mercies of God, and this request, no doubt, was heard. And we must not forget it went to the church at Rome, where there would be many Gentiles, and Gentiles of considerable ability and standing. Not men of inability, uneducated, unlearned, but gracious. We were speaking last Sabbath of laborers, laboring in God's cause. What hard work this is, evidenced here in setting the gospel and the truth before them. No easy matter. What ability it required, what wisdom, diplomacy, if you like, that he could and should approach these in such a gentle way, and that he should use such choice language, not to frighten or drive, but to draw them, which is fully in keeping with the spirit of the gospel that he was sent to preach. But his brethren, to whom the beseeching is addressed, I beseech you therefore, brethren, so that we may take this word brethren to mean not particularly brethren after the flesh by any means. But that would be a total misconstruction of the previous chapter and indeed of what he knew, seeing that he was the apostle of the Gentiles. But the brethren were that number, whether they were Jew or Gentile, bond or Scythian, out of every nation, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, upon this ground, and what God has done. Now here is the juncture, you see, of the new channel of blessing flowing out into the world, going into all the world. Here is that place where the river divides. Here is the point that God had brought his church to, where the remarkable fullness of gospel blessing was to be poured out and was being poured out in such a place as Rome. Why, who would ever go to Rome from Jerusalem to preach the gospel? And who would ever think of joining the two cities together? Why, they were miles apart. But no, here is the seat of grace, brethren. They are to be besought, pleaded with. They are to be approached in love. They've worked for the apostle to do. Point out to them the things that are yet to come to pass. And those things are set out in this 12th chapter. The practical side of gospel, the doing side of it, what the old Puritans used to call the practic part, without which there is no effect or fruit. What's the use of religion without fruit? Walk, conduct, what is the use of it? And quite apart from that, what is it in the sight of God? Oh, indeed, a solemn thing to have a name and yet to be dead, to deny the power of it, so that He had hard labor in his own soul, deep affection, but it was founded upon the rock of the covenant. And that he has spoken of. And we can almost see his feet standing firmly upon this beautiful rock as he exclaims of the unsearchable judgments of God and his ways passed by the earth. Now this is a gracious place, isn't it? Look at these rocks that we have all around us. We don't know what they're composed of, do we? We know that they stand firm. We know, as we see them in the sea and elsewhere, that they withstand storm and tempest. But of what wonderful composition, different from a sandy cliff that is gradually eroded, isn't it, by wind and wave. But here upon the solid rock of the covenant, the unsearchable riches and judgments of God, which are past finding out. How true it is, isn't it? No man can stand up and give a full and complete explanation of these judgments and unsearchable ways of God, can he? They cannot be expressed in time and will never be. But they are sufficiently revealed for the Church of God to see that they are very, very firm. Everlasting, yes, the rock of ages, as is spoken of in the 26th of Isaiah. This eternal rock, immovable and unchangeable and unalterable, respecting the remnant according to the election of grace. Therefore, this is the ground of his plea. But his plea is very particular. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. Now, I was very struck during the week as I opened quite without reference to see how the sons of Levi were purified and washed under the law in the 8th of Numbers. The Levites were purified and they washed their clothes, and Aaron offered them as an offering before the Lord, and Aaron made an atonement for them to cleanse. And after that, went the Levites in to do their service in the tabernacle of the congregation before Aaron and before his sons, as the Lord had commanded. And I felt quite comforted when I read that. I looked at no concordance or anything. In the 8th of Numbers and verses 21 on. There is the figure which I believe that Paul had in mind of those men that were taken literally. And if you go on to read it, they had to be 25 years of age when they were allowed into the the service of the sanctuary. And when they reached the age of 50, they had to leave it. So that theirs was a period of service that was of a limited duration, 25 years. But be that a figure as it is, this is undoubtedly what the apostle had in mind, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy. Not her intrinsic holiness, not holiness within you, not a holiness whereby, supposing it fell to my lot to pick out of our little company here any of you who were holy. Now how could I do? Not that holiness at all, because none of us by nature could ever be said to contain a grain of holiness. But as for the old figure, which Paul was undoubtedly familiar with, he saw the service of the sanctuary as set out by the purifying and cleansing of the Levites to the age of 25, where they were reckoned by virtue of age and choice and birth, oh yes, birth as well, to be fit for the service of the sanctuary. And they were allocated to their task. Now he sees in this great gospel scheme, the Church of God, a necessity for those who shall do likewise. But not in the same way that they should be brought out and chosen on an age limit, or that they should be purified with the washing of water, or anything else, literally. But they should present themselves, not be presented as they were then, but they should present themselves, your body, as a living sacrifice, an active, capable sacrifice. Well now, is not this exactly what divine grace has ordained? This is the whole matter of the furtherance of the Church of God. His ways are past finding out. His judgments are these. But we are plainly told that this is the way that he has revealed for his people to walk his chosen seed of Jacob. And it has been accomplished. And he has done it himself. He has called them, and they are to be his servants. Read the prophecies. Isaiah's gracious prophecies concerning the work of God's hands. They shall come from the north, the south, the east, and the west. But this is intensely personal. Now, if we look at Paul, we can see another background in it. Not only that of his Jewish upbringing and his knowledge of the law and of the way the Levites were set apart or made holy, but his own experience personally of his call by Christ. Now you put these two things together, you can see the perfection of God's work. Undoubtedly, Paul knew about the way the Levites were appointed in his knowledge of the Old Testament. But not until divine grace opened his eyes and he was himself brought to present himself. And how did he do it? Was it in a spectacular way? Did he leave his old company and friends and part with them by making some bold declaration? No, he didn't. What he did do was this. He said, said, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? Now, if you put that into the scale, then why this against the persecutor and the perjurer with those letters still in his pocket, ready to apprehend all who acknowledge Jesus Christ? You'll see that there was another background to him. And now, therefore, he is fully in a position to speak of presenting your body. And this remarkable presentation, this giving of himself, was in the utmost simplicity. Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? Well, this doing is unfolded to us, isn't it? It was a tremendous work. But there was the change. There was the devoting of himself and presenting of himself. Now, is this exceptional? I know in many things there's only one Paul and ever will be only one. And the mercy, there never will be the equal in this sense. But as regards the presenting of one's body, of one's life, one's will, one's service, through grace, there are untold numbers who are brought to this place. But they've got to be brought there. Present means a willingness. You can't drive them there, you could beseech. God beseeches, Paul beseeches, in writing to the Corinthians, he says, I beseech you to regard us as ambassadors of Christ. This beautiful word fits in so well to those who stand upon the borderline. Oh, yes. Look at the sweet freedom of gospel service. Look at the loving way God presents his truth to his dear people. The loving way he overcomes their objections and the barriers they raise. The sweet God-like manner in which he deals with sinful dust. Not to say to them, you must, not to drive them with whip like the Egyptian taskmaster, but to sweetly draw. This is his own word. Draw. Why, we can't understand this drawing, can we? You give the boy his compass, and you tell him to turn it round until that needle stands still. And his mind will ponder the way that needle stands pointing to the north. He can't understand it. And you tell him to fix it there. Tighten up the screw, leave it there, and you've got your true north. It's drawn there by what? You say, well, Daddy, how does this happen? How can this be? What draws this needle of my compass this particular way? What is it? Daddy can't tell him. Sinner tell what draws it to Christ? Can it? Can you explain what draws you to Christ? You're not asked to. You're not asked to explain it. But what you are asked is this. What is it doing for you? What is this sweet attraction? Irresistible attraction. And what is more, unalterable attraction. Oh, this isn't something recently found out in the 20th century, something that has lain hidden for years and never been understood or used by this, has been proven through the centuries, hasn't it? So is bride. Draw me, says the bride in the Song of Solomon, and we will run after thee. Oh, that this drawing must be felt. And if you feel it, you cannot be unaware of it. This presentation, therefore, of your bodies as a living sacrifice does not mean to be laid upon an altar like Isaac was. There's no such comparison as this, but it's an active, but it's a sacrifice. It's a sacrifice. Shall I say it again? It's a sacrifice. Sacrifice what? A thousand things. Give them up. Leave them. Part with them. Loss, cross, trial, temptation, nails in the flesh. Wounds, grief, sorrows. What? Yes. What, a sacrifice? Yes. It can't mean anything else other than this. It's a sacrifice. It could be said a surrender, but that isn't the word at all, and it doesn't appear in the scripture in this sense. It's a sacrifice. And what is the sacrifice? Self. Self. You. Me. Yes, and you'll have to come to it if God has dealt with you and is dealing with you. Make no mistake about it, as far off as it may seem at the moment, you'll have to come to it because God will draw you. And he will deal with you with this word, or word like it. He will so soften your heart, melt your spirit, and make you tender, that you will be willing in the day of his power. In this way, Paul puts to them the great matter of service, holy. Now this word is not to be dreaded in any way, whatever. It doesn't mean, as I have said, an intrinsic holiness. It merely means holy, as in the Old Testament meaning of the word, the furniture and fittings of the tabernacle were holy. They were not used for any other purpose. The mercy seat and the humblest vessel used in connection with it, the altar burnt offering, and all, mention what you will, the badger skins of the outer covering of the tabernacle, as rough as they were all holy. They were not used for any particular purpose. Any other purpose. And therefore, when it came to moving them, there were only particular people allowed to do it. Most interesting to read how the tabernacle was taken down by different ones who had their particular tasks. And so it is, as we come on to read this chapter, so we being many, of one body in Christ, and every one members one of another. but this later, that at the moment holy, don't regard this as being holiness as we understand it according to God's holy edict, be ye holy as I am holy. Oh no. This holiness is only by imputation, and that righteousness which God imparts. But here it's the ancient word holy, separated for a particular use. Now, is not this so? If the love of God warms your heart and constrains you to this sacrifice, will it not be a separation from other things? Will you be able, by the second verse tells us, be not conformed to this world? This is the meaning of it. This is what God has ordained. His people shall walk separately. Come ye out from among them, and be ye separate, and touch not the unclean thing. Or if you look at the 52nd of Isaiah, you will see this, be ye clean, that bear the vessels of the Lord. It is therefore a holiness as regards a separation from the world. Holy. You cannot serve two masters. You cannot offer your life an active sacrifice, a living sacrifice, unto the Lord and serve mammon as well. I know that we may try to do this. It seems a very delightful thing to flesh. It will save the nails and the crucifixion. It will save the sacrifice. Oh yes, if you can run between the two and be a liberal in your religion, neither one thing nor the other. If you can serve God and man, then you will be happy. You won't mind having a Sunday religion. If you can do what you like on Monday, you won't mind keeping your tongue quiet and sober on Sunday in the house of God and among God's people. If you can only let it run riot tomorrow, oh no. You will have a religion just as the Pharisees had, that made broad their phylacteries and loved the uppermost seats in the synagogue. But this people draweth me near to me with their lips, and honoureth me with their mouth, but their hearts are far from me. Oh yes, this middle course is eternal perdition, nothing less, except God deliver us from it. It is the cost that crucifies the flesh. And this is where the separation comes in, the holiness. They are serving the Lord with all humility of mind, as the apostle says. Again, we look at him and see that this is just what he had to do. He was hated. And after a man has been where he had been at the top of his profession, you know, and in company with all men of equal ability, this hatred of his fellow men must have been 100-fold more difficult. Oh yes, his popularity as a learned man, when it began to lose its colour and sink, and when he became less popular, and they hated him, and he had to be let down by a basket on the wall of Damascus on one occasion, when he began to be persecuted, even Ananias said, Lord, I can't go to this man. But the very first seemed that one would be touching a lion to go anywhere near him. But when he received these solemn rebuffs from his old friend and was separated from those he was once popular with, I say, what a crucifixion. Oh, none of us like this sort of thing. We would rather dwell naturally upon the mountain of popularity. But when it comes to serving the Lord with all humility of mind, being brought out and made separate, then there comes the nail, the cross, the persecution, the hatred, the enmity. It's inescapable. Indeed, it's a mark in your favour. If ye be without it, what evidence is there that your walk in front of the world is not something which they can agree with? Remember, therefore, the body is to be presented an active sacrifice. Now, what does God want it for? Why write to the Romans and say, I beseech you, brethren, to present your bodies a living sacrifice? What purpose has God done? Why, he has these men to serve. And they did too, didn't they? They also that are of Caesar's household. Oh, how sweet, blessed. And they came out of Caesar's household, called by grace from all those magnificent surroundings and all the security too. Oh yes, there's no fear of crucifixion and sacrifice in Caesar's palace, was there, naturally speaking. But let them once be identified with the gospel and the gospel grace and the apostle Paul, and out they go. They're ostracized, they're cut off, we don't want them. Is not this so, therefore, with this word, God has need of these bodies. His purpose is to be fulfilled. His work is to go on. Sinners are to be called. Sinners are to be provided for. The sanctuaries of God are to be maintained. The walls of the ministry are to be mounted by fresh men. And thus they are. Ever will be. But his way is a path finding out. They will never be fathomed. I beseech you to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy. But then it's got to pass a further test, acceptable unto God. I must leave it here, mustn't I? Just getting into the subject, aren't we? Acceptable unto God. Oh dear, who's going to stand this test? Acceptable unto God. A holy, heart-searching God. Acceptable unto God, yes. How can it be? How can it be? Guilty, unworthy heathens, as these were in many cases, should be thus enabled to present their bodies, living sacrifice, holy, separated, acceptable unto God. How? Why? Because this very work itself, this drawing, this being made willing, this readiness to count the cost, to bear the unequal strife, and so on, was already his preparatory work. This wasn't the individual doing it. Because God's work leading them on and up to, through various changing scenes, to say, Lord, take my all, this worthless heart, and make it holy thine. Amen.